Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome to the program. This evening, we are going to be talking about a subject matter that affects literally every single person's life. And what is that? It's M-O-N-E-Y, money. Now, we're going to be talking about a whole different venue regarding money that many, many people are very apprehensive about. There have been people that have lost literally millions and millions of dollars relative to it, and that's the stock market. Options, hedge funds. There are so many different aspects to investing in this particular arena. We have two very fine gentlemen that are going to be with me this evening, Scott G. Kyle and Patrick B. Fisher. Both of these men have been very deeply involved with working with people. They're financial advisors, and they have put together a book that if you are interested in understanding about investing, I believe you will find their information invaluable. It's called The Compound Code, and this is an expert guide to trading stocks and options. Now, maybe you've already done a lot of study, and maybe what we're going to discuss is something that is oh-ho-hum, familiar to you. But if you're like so many of us, we don't know anything about it, even though we may hear daily reports with the news media. So let me introduce these two gentlemen to you, Patrick Fisher and Scott Kyle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. Really looking forward to the conversation.
Both of you men have quite a background behind you. Scott Kyle, you're the CEO and Chief Investment Officer of the Coastwise Capital Group, and you call yourself a boutique money management firm. Now, you're in California. You also are the co-founder of the Active Network, Inc., and you serve there as the CFO and board of director. You have a number of different educational credentials, but I found it interesting that you're also a two-time world champion sailor, an Ironman triathlon finisher, and a third-degree black belt in Shaolin Kempo. Well, and then Patrick, you're a financial advisor at Coastwide Capital Group, and you began your association with Scott at G2 Capital Management in 2002, and you started off as an equity research associate, and then you also co-managed a systematic global macro hedge fund at Mellon Capital Management in San Francisco, and you've got quite an educational background, too, and you have been involved with triathlon sports as well. And you're very, very active in other physical activities. You guys really have quite a unique combination of talents and even compatible interests. Anybody that can do a triathlon, you have to have patience in dealing with stocks. I mean, good grief, that would keep anybody mentally sharp. Well, I wanted to ask you, and I know I did before we started, you said it took you about not quite 2 years to put this book together. What made you decide that you wanted to put in black and white what your experience has taught you?
Yeah, this is Scott here, and thank you for the question, Donna. We work with clients around the country on a very in-depth basis, so we're talking to them, getting to know them, their families, their financial situations, their fears, etc. And that's extremely satisfying, rewarding for us to do. But it's also nice to be able to share some of our values as well as the lessons that we've learned over the decades with a broader audience. And so this book allows us to communicate to people above and beyond our clients. And we really focus both with our clients and generally speaking on education and informing, because our philosophy is the more educated and informed people are, the better decisions they can make.
Patrick, what is your feeling relative to what Scott just said. I know the two of you have put this book together. Was there anything different that made you feel that this was extremely important to be able to put in black and white what you know?
Scott hit the nail on the head, and I think the other bit that's worth highlighting is that we've known each other for over 20 years. We've been friends and colleagues for most of that time. And so I think it sort of represents, you know, the learnings that we've had over decades of experience, whether it's on the institutional side or the private wealth side. And really, it's something that we're proud of to sort of share with, you know, the existing audience, which is our client base, as well as, you know, other audiences that might see value in the learnings that we've had.
In 2020, right at the very beginning of your book, you talk about how the 10-year Treasury dropped to an all-time low of 0.318%. Now, for many people hearing that, they will say, well, what's the big deal about that? Stocks and bonds, options, hedge funds, when you start talking about these things, most people's eyes begin to cross because they really don't know very much about it. Yet they feel that this is something that maybe will give them security in the future. Why was this such a significant drop in 2020?
Yeah, there were a few events that all came together at the same time. So, of course, the pandemic really disrupted much of our lives,
mm-hmm.
our health lives, our work lives, family lives, and also for many people, their financial lives as well. So during that time, interest rates were being lowered by our Federal Reserve, and they're the ones who control interest rates, dropped repeatedly in order to stimulate the economy, which was really, you know, to put it mildly, falling off a cliff for these highly unusual reasons, namely with the pandemic. And so that led interest rates to drop to all-time lows, which for people who rely on their savings for income, for retirement, for example, really posed a problem. And so a lot of people who were used to getting, like when I started investing back in the 80s, interest rates were 18% under Ronald Reagan. So it just shows how far they had dropped over the years. And so we wanted to highlight that with interest rates so low, it was very difficult for people to generate the income they needed to pay their bills month to month. And then in the book, we talk about ways to generate income in more effective ways, using dividends, stocks, et cetera, which I'm sure we'll get into later in the conversation.
Yes. Now, Patrick, you yourself also have direct involvement, obviously, in working with people. And the statement in the book is, success is driven both by science, technical proficiency, as well as art, the learned ability to do things well. So many people, Patrick, will say, I read the stock, you know, market readings in the paper, Wall Street Journal, whatever they choose to use as their source of information, and they will find, sometimes they get in a panic because they'll see numbers drop or maybe they go up, and it almost seems like gambling. When you have a client that comes into you, and as Scott was saying, you do evaluations of them, you want to get to know them so that you can advise them in what you feel is the best environment for them to consider. What are some of those beginning steps that are utilized?
That's a great question, Donna. I think you're spot on in the sense that so oftentimes people will see the media, whether that's the news, or they're reading something in the paper, or they're seeing it on television, and they'll get concerned whether it's a short-term price movement or some short-term bad news. But to answer your question about what we look for in the beginning of a conversation with a new client, I think probably the most important thing to understand from the client is their time horizon. And what I mean by that, simply put, is when do they need the money back? If their time horizon is 5 or 10 years, then really, really, they're better served not looking at short-term price fluctuations, because over a decade, equities are sure to outperform almost any other asset class. There's always going to be short-term noise in any part in that time horizon, but over the course of a decade, it will perform very well. Same thing if their time horizon is 3 or 6 months or even 12 months, if they're going to potentially buy a home or they need to use some money to pay for college or something like this. Even if equities look very good or very cheap, given their time horizon, it's not the best place to go because you can never tell the short-term price movements from day to day. So I think really as we get to know a prospective client, among many other variables that we consider, probably the most important is time horizon because that will dictate where we should be putting the money in broad asset allocation terms.
And if I may add to that, and that Patrick very well said, the way to think about that is rule number one in investing is match your investments with your time horizon. As Patrick said, if you need money for lunch tomorrow, doesn't matter if we're in a bull market, a bear market, or sideways market, that money should be in something short-term, like cash or bonds. If you don't need the money for 10 years or more, retirement, et cetera, then the money should mostly be in stocks. By definition, if you don't need the money in 10 years, if your future self needs the money, not your current self, then what happens day-to-day in the news literally doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is how will stocks be 5, 8, 10 years from now, and in virtually any 10-year period, stocks rise over that time.
You bring up Warren Buffett. He's a billionaire, so there are so many people that devour his books. I have a friend that just says, boy, I've got all of his books, anything that's ever been published about him. He follows him like he is a disciple of a guru. And this Warren Buffett is a man that really does a lot of homework before he gives anybody anything. Let's talk about a man that has really achieved so significantly what other people yearn to do. What do you think is one of his biggest, I can't call it a secret, but one of his biggest strengths when it comes to making investments in stocks or any other commodity?
Yeah, Scott here, I'll name two, which are probably the two most important. First is he knows what he knows, and he knows what he doesn't know. So he's humble enough to know his circle of competence, and he stays within that circle of competence. Because there are so many ideas that are thrown at us by the media, for example, that people think they need to know and take action on everything, whereas in reality, you don't need that many investments to do well over time. So number one is know what you know. Number two, and that relates to that, is keep things simple. Again, there's these complex investment strategies or investment products that are really often not in the best interest of investors, so keep things simple. And then the third attribute of Warren Buffett that allows him to be successful is that he has the right emotional temperament. In other words, you know, the saying is, be fearful when people are greedy and be greedy when people are fearful. And it's not just a phrase. He really acts that way. When the market crashed in 2008, 2009, he invested about $50 billion into the market when people were literally selling hand over fist. And everyone thought, you know, the world is going to end. This is the end. But he had faith and belief, and he understood what he was investing in. He kept things simple. And he ultimately, of course, made a lot of money. And when people look back on market declines, whether it was a pandemic or the crash of 2008, 2009, in the moment, all their emotions told them, sell, sell, sell. But in retrospect, if you look back, you tell yourself, your old self, buy, buy, buy. It was a great time to buy. Of course, prices were low. So he has the right emotional temperament, which is frankly where most investors go wrong. It's not that they don't have the mental acumen, or it's not that they can't do the math. They simply let their emotions take over, and most people's brains are not wired emotionally to make good investment decisions. They're good for looking at art and being passionate and love and many other things, but most people's minds are simply not wired to make good investment decisions.
Patrick, I was intrigued, and I've heard this for so many years, the value of compounding. Now, when you talk about a home, people will say, my home's going to go up in value. This is an investment for me. And depending on where you are, I mean, your home might double, triple, quadruple, you know, in a lifetime. I've got a friend in California that her house is worth over $1 million. It was built, I think, back in the 60s. And she said, it's all about location, 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 Donna. She said, I don't understand why it's worth $1 million, but her house has compounded for her, and she's a senior, and if ever she needs any money for repairs, et cetera, she has her home equity that can work for her. So there is a compounding effect relative to that. Not everybody's going to have that happen as she has because of where she is. So let's talk about compounding with stocks, and let's start with stocks because that is something that's very perplexing if you look at it just as, gee, this is a way to make money. What's the best way to deal with the compounding effect, and how can it work for you with stocks, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. So in very basic terms, if you were to kind of think about the stock market as going up, call it 8% per year, for conversation's sake, to make the math a little easier, we'll say 10%. Of course, it's not going to go up 10%. You know, every year it might go up 1% one year, 20% the next year, down 10% the next year, up 30%. But for conversation's sake, we'll say 10%. So if you start with $100 on January 1st and it goes up 10%, at the end of the year on December 31st, you're having the New Year's party, you have $110 because you've got 10% return. So now on January 1st the following year, you have $110 and that goes up 10%. Now you've earned $11, you've got $121. And so the beauty of compounding is that as long as you're not touching the principal, over time, every year on January 1st, you're starting with more money so that you're compounding the same return with a larger principal base. Now, I'm far from a real estate expert by any stretch of the imagination. The thing that has real estate going for it, you know, for better or worse, is that you've got leverage by virtue of a mortgage oftentimes. But the same thing would happen with real estate or other asset classes where if it is increasing in value over time by virtue of a percentage, each year you're starting with, you know, a higher capital base to invest in. Now, you can do other things like having dividends and having call options and those other things we can speak about later in the show, but that's really the basic mathematics of compounding is, you know, each year you're starting with a higher principal base to compound.
Let's address the compounding with dividends. There are those stocks that you may not get a dividend when you invest in them, but you look at it as something that's long-term and that you will get to that point where maybe you want to sell it or you just want to hold on to it just because it's a very good company. Maybe it is a medical company that really does phenomenal things with their research and development, or it could be an oil company. I mean, there's literally thousands and thousands of choices that people can have. And you emphasize in the book how important dividends are. Why are dividends better than, if that's the case, than not having dividends from a stock investment? What's the positive and the negative?
Sure, Scott here. So you do, like you said, Donna, you have stocks like Google or Amazon that pay no dividends, and they can be great companies for long term. And you have typically more mature or established stocks like a Johnson & Johnson or Coca-Cola that pay dividends. And in some cases, like Coca-Cola, have been paying dividends for over a decade. Coca-Cola started paying a dividend in 1901, and they paid a dividend every quarter or 90 days, uninterrupted, even throughout the Depression, the Recession, the pandemic, et cetera, every 90 days for that entire period. So using Patrick's example in terms of tying dividends to compounding, let's say you start with that $100. You own one share of a stock with $100, and it has a 4% dividend yield, meaning that it pays out $4 per year, or 4%, which would be a typical dividend-paying stock. When you get the first dividend, or $1, because they pay four times a year, and I'm just going to assume that the price doesn't fluctuate of the stock, then now you own 101 shares. And now when you get that second dividend 90 days later, now you're getting a dividend not on 100 shares, but 101 shares. So the compounding effect for dividend-paying stocks can be very dramatic because you're compounding four times a year if the company pays a dividend four times a year. And then on top of that, what you could call compounding on steroids is that after 365 days, many of these companies like Coca-Cola will increase their dividend every year. What that means is that you started with $100 worth and you end up with $104 worth because you got $4 worth of dividends. But actually those compounded, so you have actually more closer to $105 worth. And then they'll raise the dividend, call it 10%. And so that really starts what we call the flywheel of compounding, so that the dividends over time can actually pay out more than your original investment. In other words, after about 10 years of compounding, you'll earn more in dividends per year, over $100, than your original investment. And so the reason why dividends can be important are twofold. One is some people rely on dividends as a source of income to pay their bills. Let's say they're in retirement or they've lost their job. So dividends, unlike stock price, if you buy the right companies, tend to be very reliable sources of income or profits. Secondly, the companies that pay dividends, Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, they take pride and they know that their shareholders want that dividend every 90 days. As such, they manage their business to ensure that that payment's going to be made every 90 days. So it just instills a discipline within the company to really manage their expenses and their revenues in a way to make sure that they're continuing to both pay out that dividend as well as increase the dividend. Because the last thing a company wants to do is to cut its dividend because they know they'll disappoint their shareholders and their stock price will go down. So there's all sorts of benefits for owning dividend-paying stocks. Even if you don't need the income, dividend-paying stocks just tend to perform well over time because of that discipline from the management that they know that they have to pay out a certain amount of their profits in the form of a dividend each quarter.
Patrick, there is a section in the book, and it's a power tip, and it's when to hold them and when to fold them. Kenny Rogers had a very popular song relative to that statement, and that is almost like what people really get very anxious about because they think, gee, if this has happened, for example, the pandemic that occurred, so many people were in really sad circumstances, and many, many companies were affected because of the lockdown. So people, if they have a portfolio and it is diversified, they may not get hit as hard. But let's say someone is in a situation where it is to their advantage to sell their stocks. How do you do that? And this might be relating to options. It might be relating to something associated with dividends, depending on the company. What do you have to consider when you have stocks? Because not every stock should be kept for 40 or 50 years.
Sure, that's a great question. And I think assuming it is a stock that either you want to sell or you need to sell, and it could be any combination of things where you might have a lot of one stock you're looking to diversify, you might be looking to raise cash to pay for college or pay for a mortgage, you might need the funds for something else. There are many things that you look for when you're looking to sell a stock. One could be the realized gain or loss, because there could be a reason that you might want to sell a position that's at a loss from a tax perspective versus one at a gain. And the other, to kind of highlight the point that you made about options, is that this is a great scenario where you can use call options, where you own the stock and you write a call or you sell the call and give someone else the option to buy it, ideally at a higher price in a future date. And you're given a premium or a dollar amount in return for selling effectively that insurance contract. So if you're in a position where you're looking to sell stocks, whether it's to diversify, raise cash, or otherwise, either looking at the tax implications of the position you're selling and or selling call options around it is a great way to do that.
There is a statement you make in your book that if you decide, if you hear something on the news, something's going down the sink big time, really big time, and there might be people making statements, this company may not have a chance to survive. There's a comment in your book that says, wait 3 days before you make a decision. J. Paul Getty was very strong on that. He said, if there's anyone that wants to buy something from you or sell something to you, listen to what they have to say and then wait a few days. Give yourself the time to really look at what's going on. Some people might ask a question, what do you do when you feel like you've got to have the sale? How do you move quickly on these things? Because they're concerned that everything might crash. I mean, this is what we've been given in the way of the stock market crash, all the historical information with that and how many people just lost everything. And this is something, Scott, what would you say to someone that comes in a panic with you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And indeed, as I said before, many people base their decisions on short-term emotions, and then they'll often look back not that long after, it could be 6 months, 12 months, a relatively short time horizon, and regret the action they took. Let's use the pandemic as an example. The stock market dropped from January of 2020 through April of 2020 about 35%, which is a crash in anyone's book. But then it rallied shortly thereafter and ended up finishing them up for the year over 17%. So if you had sold in a panic in March or April of 2020, not because you needed the money, but because you're simply letting your emotions take over, you would have looked back literally within months and regretted that decision. Because remember, the goal here is to buy low and sell high, not buy high and sell low. So, you know, bring this all together. If you have a good financial plan, then you will have already mitigated the risk or protected against stock market declines. How so? Because you will have already set aside cash for your short-term needs to cover your mortgage, to cover any travel you want to take, etc. And that money will be in either cash or bonds, which didn't crash 35%. Cash stayed flat. Bonds actually went up during that period because you were diversified across asset classes. So by definition, anything you have in stocks should be money that you don't need for a long period of time. So, but we are emotional creatures, and so what I would advise people is to say, has your plan changed? Do you need this money in the near term? And if the plan hasn't changed, then we've already covered your needs for the next couple of years, meaning that stock, which is now down, like Starbucks was down almost 50%, many great companies were down, 35, 40% or more. Does that company still serve your purpose? And in cases, the answer is yes, because they're just looking at the price. They're looking at like a leaf on a tree. They're not looking at the whole forest. So that would be the conversation we would have with clients to try to get them off the proverbial ledge, as it were. And in 99 out of 100 cases, a few months later, they'll thank us, saying, "Thank goodness you didn't, that I didn't sell, and I kind of wish you had told me to buy," right? Because again, by definition, you'd rather buy low than buy high. Conversely, because people do feel the need to take action, sometimes a stock is down a lot, and they're thinking of buying, or they just maybe hear it on TV, on some financial show, and they feel the need to take action immediately, like they're going to miss an opportunity. And that's where the three-day wait rule, really comes in. Because by definition, and this all ties together, if you're going to own a stock, it should be for a three-year or more holding period. And so waiting a day or two or three is not going to make the difference in terms of your returns, but making a bad decision in the short term based on emotions could impact your returns over time. So you're never going to go wrong by waiting a couple of days to buy a stock, because you'd rather do things correctly than quickly when it comes to investing. So that really covers both sides. The panic, I want to sell, and you go back to the basics. What's the plan? Do you have money to cover your near-term needs? Yes. Then why do we need to sell something that's likely going to go back up within the next 6 to 12 months? Because most bear markets last less than a year. And then on the buy side, let's think for a day or two before we make this purchase and make sure it fits into the plan.
I know with both of you, you feel that researching companies is very, very important. Profit and loss statements, and this is very detail-oriented. And looking at a company, what their track record is, how long have they been in business, what is known about the company, what kind of rating do they have as far as going up and down. I think of Boeing, which is an excellent company, but they have gone through so many ups and downs from the time that they started that it is something that you almost expect from them. And it is holding true and holding stable and holding steady because their stock is something that is very, very valuable. They're an incredible company. Of course, they're here in the Pacific Northwest where I'm located. But it's something that to do that research really takes diligence. Now, you've got so much wonderful information in your book, The Compound Code. I want to go to developing a portfolio. And when you're working with people, Do you find that most of the people that come to you that want to set up a portfolio are of the younger generation, or do you find people in retirement suddenly deciding that they want to have a portfolio to achieve a certain amount of independence? Let's face it, those of us that are going into our senior years, or maybe are in our senior years, someone might say, why bother? But what typically is the age group, if there is that kind of designation, with the people that you work with?
I'll take this, as Patrick. I think that there's no typical age. There's no right age. I think that you could, on the one hand, say, you know, the earlier the better, because you have more power of compounding on your side if you've got many, many decades to let the portfolio work for you. But even if you are working with someone who is going into retirement, perhaps even retired, they still, you know, quite likely have 20 or 30 years, if not more, to live. And so even someone who is close to retirement, they still have a quite a long time horizon. And so I think, you know, we don't select or you know, our clients don't self-select a certain age bracket in which they say this is the right time to start. Certainly the sooner the better, just from the perspective of saving money, investing money, and letting it compound over time. But I think the reason for someone in their later years to invest in a portfolio of stocks and bonds is that it is extremely liquid. So if something were to change in their financial plan and they need to raise money, they can sell it in the open market after, of course, the three-day rule, and have the funds, you know, within a week. Whereas if it's locked up in something like real estate, albeit it could be a great investment, you know, it's not always the case that you can sell a property, you know, in a couple of days. And so I think the time horizon often is much longer than people realize or think, even if they are, you know, in retirement or close to retirement. And, you know, I think one of the advantages is that you do have a real ability to diversify with having a portfolio of many, many stocks and bonds, but also you have liquidity, you know, if and when you were to need the money back.
You make a statement in the book, gentlemen, that the average investor does not know what he is investing in. He's not researched the fundamentals of the underlying business. Thus, it's not surprising that studies indicate the average investor's returns over the last 20 to 30 years have been about one-third of what the market has returned over time. Would you say that is based on the S&P 500 in general, or is there another arena that would need to be considered as well?
Yeah, Scott here. So the way I would frame that is, just because something's easy to do doesn't mean it's simple to do. In other words, it used to be when to invest, you'd have to call up your broker. You know, this was decades ago before the internet, and there were sort of more barriers to entry. It was more expensive to invest because commissions were much higher. Now with the advent of the internet, it literally one click of a button and you can buy and sell a stock. So it's easy to execute, but that doesn't mean it's simple to actually do successfully. So it really comes down to, you know, the emotions around investing. And there, as I said before, most people with no fault of their own really are not well, they don't have the right temperament to invest. And so the studies show that the reason why people tend to underperform the market, and that's used to S&P 500, which is a very good index to compare one's results to, because it represents about 70% of all publicly traded securities in the S&P 500, people underperform that by somewhere between 50 and 70%. Why? Because they tend to buy high and sell low. The very things we've been talking about during this conversation, they let their emotions take over, whether it's on the greed side, so they hear about electric vehicles, they see Rivian or some company that's a new company go up, and they can't take it anymore, and they're like, fine, I'll buy now, and then right as the company peaks, and then it goes down, and then they'll sell. Or conversely, they'll own some great company like Amazon. Amazon has dropped over 50% 13 times since it went public, a little over 20 years ago. If you had panicked and sold Amazon any of those times, you would have missed out on great gains. And so that's why the idea of having a long-term time horizon and not panicking and not reacting based on short-term events is so important, because I can't tell you how many times we've convinced clients to not sell when the stock market is down because they don't need the money. They thanked us after the fact, but if they had, rather than getting somewhere around a stock market return of 7, 8, 9%, they would be getting the typical return of the average investor, which is around 3, 4, 5%, simply because they let their emotions take over and they didn't follow a plan for the long term. You hear about these people who bought a few stocks and then they literally tucked them away, and they, when they're 90 years old, they're worth millions of dollars. That's because they have two things on their side. One, they're not taking action all the time and trying to buy the latest thing and then sell the latest thing. And two, they've let compound work for them. So really, the more simple approach you take, and the more you simply don't make some basic mistakes, the more likely you are to succeed over time.
Well, gentlemen, this conversation, I think, is really giving an insight. Now, maybe some of my listeners are familiar with the stock market, but I've known people that honestly did not know how to work the stock market, and they're on the computers almost every single day, looking at this, that, or the other. And one person I know said that their spouse doesn't even want him, you know, to talk about it because they just get so stressed over the fact that this is like gambling. And in a way, it is, but if you do it thoughtfully and well and do your homework, as you said, you can leave it alone. I know of a school teacher, she ended up becoming a millionaire because her brother worked with the money, the savings she had, and it was over a period of years, and by the time she reached retirement, she was worth well over $1 million, which she totally surprised her. She had no idea what was being done. And there's all kinds of stories that I think are fascinating relative to the compound code, the effect of compounding, which is very, very significant, and I think that the stock market has proven exactly what you have shared this evening. Now, Scott and Patrick, you have a website. It's thecoastwidegroup.com. People can go there to find out about the book. They can also get the book, The Compound Code, on Amazon, and that will enable them, too, to have easy access. I want to thank both of you gentlemen for being with me. This has been, well, it was quite a read, and if you could see the book, it's highlighted in so many different ways. But it really is an education. This is something that can bring a lot of good to a lot of people. And I think the younger you are, when you can have an understanding of this and have a trusted financial advisor, I think this is very, very good. And I think, just like you said, Patrick, it doesn't make any difference what your age is. What makes a difference is, why is it you want to do investing, what is the purpose behind it, and becoming educated about the whole thing. Gentlemen, this has been quite a pleasure. Thank you for being my guest this evening.
Thank you, Donna. It's been a pleasure for us.
Thank you so much, Donna.
My pleasure. Donna Sebo here. I'm saying goodbye to Scott, Kyle, and Patrick Fisher, and I want to be sure to give you their website again. It's coastwidegroup.com. We're saying goodbye to them, and we're moving along with the programming, and I want you to know that this guide to trading stocks and options, it really is very, very informative. And if you're married and you've got a spouse that says, oh, that's a bunch of hooey, you ought to check it out. And by the way, I want to give you a tidbit, ladies. They have found that women do really, really good with investing. Mm-hmm. They used to have those little stock clubs that they would get together, and the women would decide on investing smaller amounts of money, and the compounding effect that they typically experienced when the records were checked, they did quite well. So this is not a man's world only, as it has often been, well, expressed as. No. Mm-mm. Anybody can participate in this. Gender doesn't matter, just like money doesn't care who handles it and who spends it. We're taking a break. 253-582-5597. If you'd like to chat with me, 253-582-5597. We're taking a little bit of a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio, able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. I believe we have a caller on the line, and caller, stay with me. I'll be with you shortly. I want to let you know who's coming up on my program tomorrow evening. And, you know, we're coming to the end of August, and so we've only got 3 more shows before the 1st of September comes into our space. We're going to be talking tomorrow evening with a gentleman in England. Alex Schrinjauer is his name, and he is an expert with facial reflexology. It's absolutely fascinating. And then we're going to be breaking the terminal cancer misdiagnosis book with Danny Carroll. And then the last show of the month of August is Maximize Your Healing Power with Sharon Martin. We've just got so much going on. And then we're going to start off September with Ancient Wisdom Scrolls with Von Broschler. Now, for those of you that are regular listeners, you may have been disappointed that when you listened to the show where Von Broschler was supposed to be featured, all you got was a bunch of static. Well, we didn't know that the software in the system had become corrupted. And what has happened is that we redid the interview, and so we're airing it on the 1st of September. And we apologize for that happening. There was nothing we could do about it. And we were able to work through the challenge. And fortunately, that was the only show that ended up being trash, to be perfectly honest. So I want you to know about that. Also, all of my television shows, all 5 of them, are now up on YouTube and also on my website under the video section. So you can go into either place. And if you go into my last newsletter, which was for the month of August, and my newsletters come out on the 1st of every month, you will find 2 links, one for YouTube and one for the website. And they'll take you directly to the Donna Sebo Show Special Editions. And that is my television programming. So there are 5 shows that have been done. We've got a couple of other shows. I'm only able to do 1 television show a month. That's all that my schedule will allow. But oh my goodness, it's just amazing. And don't forget to check out the Author's Showcase. And we have authors that we're going to be adding there that are featured and are supportive of this programming, which I greatly appreciate. It is much, much value in having these people say it's worth paying, you know, it's worth being on your programming, and it means a lot. So anyway, that being said, we're going to check and see who our caller is. Hi, thank you for your patience in waiting. This is Donna.
Hi, Donna. This is Eve from Lakewood.
Hi, Eve from Lakewood. My goodness, we've got rain coming in. Can you believe that after all the high temps we've gone through?
Mm-mm. I'll take it.
You'll take it. I think you and everybody else here is going to take it. All right, let's get down to business with you, Eve. And again, thank you for your patience in waiting. The first thing that I am looking at is the word discipline. Now, you have a discipline side, but there has been what I would call sort of a feeling like you're in a fog. And it's not because you're not a productive person. That's not it. You're just feeling like you're in a zone of limbo. Maybe that's a better way of describing it. It's really odd. And you'll find yourself wondering, gee whiz, am I stuck? Am I not paying attention to something I should be paying attention to? And I would say, no, you're doing just fine. I would relax and not get too upset over the fact that you seem to have a stalemate. And it's not really a stalemate. You are just in a cycle where I would say this is the time to take care of things that you normally don't want to give your time to, but you know that you should, and it'll take a little bit, and you just go ahead and redo your priorities for a while. And just know, keep your eye on the goal and the objective that you would like to reach before the end of this year, and give yourself a little bit more time. You are going to find that there is a lot coming down the pipeline of the universe into your space, and I watch you with interest because it seems like around the 2nd of February of the new year, 2024, you're picking up a momentum, and it's not going to be as you would maybe like it to be or assume that it should be, but you're being very gradually adapted to introduce yourself into a new environment of action that's going to enable you to discover a whole new, I'll use the word environment again, a diversified environment that is going to bring to you options of choice that's unlike anything that you've ever had before. And this has to do with your professional life. It has to do with your personal life. It has to do with your spiritual self, your emotional self. And there is this adaptation that I'm looking at around you, very slowly evolving. It's not fast moving. It's very slowly happening. And it doesn't surprise me that you might feel that you're at stuck, but you're not. You're not stuck. If you could just be aware that you're doing, in a sense, a balancing act, because you are letting go of some of the old aspects of habit, may even be certain beliefs that you had on a subconscious level or conscious level, and you're just slowly, very slowly, doing the adaptation. I like what I see, but I can also empathize with you because it is very frustrating. It's like you've got blinders on, yet you don't have blinders on. And you can't put things into a box of expectation because it won't work. It just won't work. So you've got a lot going on here. And another aspect that I'm watching very, very carefully is that there is a big goal, an objective, that you've held within yourself for a long time, and you felt like you had to reach a certain age before you would do it. There's all kinds of boundaries that you've put around it, and I want to say that's not necessary. I would like for you to bring that aspiration out into the open for yourself and realize you don't have to set a time limit on it. And it is not associated with finance, which intrigues me. It intrigues me because finances will enable you to do the goal, but I think it's going to be achieved in a way that is not expected. No partnership per se, but it is going to be achieved in a way that is not expected. So if I could encourage you between now and the end of the year, take time to carry a notebook with you, go for walks. You know, it's a little bit cooler now. Just get out and maybe stop at a Starbucks or someplace where you can just sit and quietly write down your thoughts. And I feel that you're going to literally redesign objectives. And I'm intrigued with this because you're going to realize how simple it is to redesign what you're looking at and what you feel you have had that was an objective that was very, very important. And you don't realize how far you've come to actually reach an objective. This is a big, it's for you, it's a very big objective. So I'm looking at it Finances will be it, but the finances are not the focus. The finances aren't the focus. It's something that for you means a great deal. And it enables you to have the independence that you want. And it also will enable you to participate in life in a way that makes you feel that you're making a difference. Now, that may sound rather vague. I don't know what this is that is deep within you, but you've been carrying it for a very, very long time. And you've kept it close to your chest. You've not shared it with very many people. And you say, I don't want to do that because I don't want anybody to put me down for it or think it's silly or even to take advantage of you. You want to do it in your own way, and you will. You will be able to do it. And keep up your writing. That's very important. Your writing and your creativity needs to be nourished as well, because it all is going to go into that package. Do you have a question for me?
I do have a question, but thank you. That was very insightful and means a lot to me, so thank you. I have a trip coming up, and I'm wondering what you see for me and if you have any advice for me for that trip.
Where are you going and when?
I am going to the Burning Man Festival tomorrow.
You know what? I think it's good you're going. But I do feel a sense of disappointment. So I think if you can go on this trip and not have any expectations whatsoever, just be an observer and enjoy what's going on and what's there, and ask yourself the question, why is it that I am wanting to, I'm wanting something, I'm looking for something? So you're an explorer with this trip, and that's what you need to pay attention to. You need to ask yourself what it is that is the trigger for the curiosity. Why? And you don't need to cross-examine yourself, you know, like a Perry Mason special. That's not necessary. But what I'm saying is you're discovering something about yourself by doing this trip. And I think that the interactions with different people, if you can be non-judgmental and just observe and enjoy the conversations you have with people, I think it's going to be a very insightful trip in many, many respects. But there is something, there's a word of caution that I'm getting. You're not going to be harmed in any way. There's none of that. But it's think about what you hear from people. Just be a good observer. I think this is opening up a part of you that you have kept in a lockdown, because you didn't know that it was appropriate for you to investigate. But it's perfectly fine. I'm seeing the lock being unlocked. And I think you're going to come back from the trip. Is it about 3 or 4 days that you're going to be gone?
Yes.
All right. I think you ought to keep a notebook, a journal, about what you see, what you absorb in the way of observation. What kind of feelings you're picking up? Is there apprehension? Do you feel like you've been thrown back in time? There's just a lot of questions that I feel you may have, and I think writing them out is very, very good. So be sure you have a small journal with you so you can write down what you feel, and then after you get home, after you're home for about a week or so, then open it up and reread it. And I think you're going to find that there's a part of you that has been suppressed for a very, very long time. And this has, in a way, liberated you from some of what you feel is oppressive. And you're finding out it's not oppressive at all. But it's just something that you did because somewhere along the line, you were intimidated by someone's opinion. And consequently, did not have, well, what do I want to say? You were not able to recognize that their opinion came from their own biases, not from who and what you really know yourself to be. So there's all kinds of things, little bits and pieces that I'm picking up here that formulated a concern. So I think it's good you're going. and it will be a safe trip, but you need to be alert and be aware. Do I make sense?
Yes. Perfect sense.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for calling into the show.
Thank you, Donna.
It's my pleasure. Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo. We're saying goodbye to E. And by golly, you know what? There is so much going on in life. I stop and I observe and I pay attention to different things that are going on. I'll see certain news reports and we're, you know, within a split second, we're in Malaysia or we're talking about the flooding in China or the fires in Spain. And we've got so many different things that are going on. And if you just stop for a moment and you think about being in a grocery store, and I do this every once in a while, and it's a lot of fun for me. I just think that this is lovely. But if you just look at all of the different people, you can do this in a shopping mall, too. You can sit at a McDonald's or what have you, have a cup of tea or coffee, hamburger, whatever's your pleasure, and just people watch. I can remember when I was growing up that there were certain individuals that I knew that said one of their greatest satisfactions was just watching people. And watching how they walked and, you know, how they were dressed and what did their faces look like. There was just so much that you could see. And I have found that that is really something to, you know, something to really take the time to do every once in a while. One, it gets you out of yourself. And two, you might end up having conversation with strangers that you never would have imagined. Let me tell you what happened to me. I was in New York City. And in New York City, this was before COVID, and I was on a business trip, and I wanted to just get out because the schedule was very hectic, and I wasn't going to be there very long. And I stopped in at a McDonald's to get something to eat. Well, this McDonald's in New York City was two-story McDonald's, and they were packed. Well, there's this little bitty table, and it was set up for two people, and I sit down because it was vacant at the moment, and there was someone that came and sat down. Do you mind, they asked me, if I would sit with you? I said, no. And it was a woman, and we were chatting back and forth. Perfect stranger, and I found out she was from France. And that she flew into New York City to do the shopping for her family, for clothes. And I just remembered thinking to myself, oh my goodness, you fly in from France to do your clothes shopping in New York. You must be very, very wealthy. The truth was she saved so much money that she could make the trip. And it was something she'd been doing for a number of years. And, of course, she loved New York. And she knew where all the sales were going on. And she just had a wonderful time. And she had a friend that she stayed with, too, when she came to New York. But we sat there, and we had the best conversations. And I told her about some places that I had discovered. And she told me about some places that she knew about. And there was just this wonderful conversation with a perfect stranger. And though we exchanged names, we're never going to meet again. But it's one of those things that was so lovely. And the place was just packed, all kinds of people in there. And that's something that you found in New York City. You could talk to just about anybody. And you had all of these characters, if you will, with their costumes and their different things that they did. Some would have stalls on the street, or others would be, you know, just going from one job to another. You know, a lot of the movies you see about New York City, like the big racks with the clothing going down the street to go from in the garment district from one place to another. All of that really is what's going on there. It's a fascinating place to be. But sometimes we have gotten, well, not sometimes, we have become so afraid of communicating with people we don't know anything about. And it's time for us to get out of that structure of thinking. Sometimes meeting a perfect stranger, and I just saw an article about that. They said, you know what? You can talk to strangers now. And I said, when could you not talk to strangers, for heaven's sakes? Remember, life is for living. And it is for the enjoyment and pleasure of observing and for being able to see, maybe in a whole new way, the world, life, and, oh, all that it has to offer. Remember, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. That's your business. It does not belong to anyone else. Donna Sebo here. I'll be talking with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.